speaking about the indulgent mind. The indulgent mind. So if anybody feels that that doesn't represent some quality, then they're free to get up and go. But I don't think there are going to be mass exodus here. The indulgent mind. It's interesting. Sometimes I think those of us who were born in this time and in this place, meaning the U.S., and I'm, this time being through the 1950s till now, are thick-headed. So why are we thick-headed? Well, because we need so much affluence to wake us up. I mean, I don't think that there will be a time on earth that we will have the degree of available resources that we do now and the affluence associated with it. Because if you look at the time charts, resources are fastly depleting, and with the diminishing resources comes a diminishing lifestyle. It's inherent in the process. So we're at the apogee of the orbit. We're at the crest of the hill here. And I think that some of us have to have gone through everything that the earth can possibly provide before we say, is there anything else here? I mean, is this it? Because you can see, no matter how indulgent we become with those resources, there's still the pervasive sense of existential crisis that we all face, that we have pain, that we feel isolated and cut off from things, that the sense of connection and interconnection doesn't seem to be at hand. And it dawns on us that the pursuit of pleasurable stimulation is not going to alter that predicament as much as we like to pretend it does in this culture with our ethos. So I don't, you know, if you ever venture out, which I hope all of you get a chance to do, into some third worlds, or people that just don't live with this degree of abundance, just look at life and how it is in its raw form. I remember I once got off of a train in Calcutta, and there's a big open courtyard right across from the train station. This huge three-story pile of garbage right across the street. That's the way it is in India. And it was winter, and buried into the garbage because of the composting heat were people who were living in caved out into that pile of garbage. And suddenly I said, oh, this is not Kansas. Just take that in. Just look at that and take it in. Don't dismiss it. Take it in. Because that is the human condition. Actually, when I came back from Asia, I decided I would fast one day a week, not for any health reasons, but just because I wanted to feel the hunger which connected me with the rest of the world. And we can't pretend that that doesn't exist. I don't know how many of you saw today's paper about a Mexican woman who in the year 2000, because she was some 300 miles from the closest hospital and was having a enormously hard delivery, took a knife and gave herself a C-section and lived, though the baby did not. This is the world. And we are so insulated within our pursuit of the pleasures that we have created a kind of fiction within all of this, really. Although the pain certainly percolates through. And we get very defensive. It's an interesting country we're in. You know, I don't know given the times, how much longer we're going to be able to speak this way about it. I wonder that sometimes. But because the rest of the world doesn't have the availability of resources or the money to purchase them, such as this country consumes 25% of the oil and it's 5% of the population. 25% of the world's oil and we're 5% of the population. And any threat to that, any threat to our spirit of indulgence, brings enormous defensiveness and arrogance. You're not going to change our lifestyle. Sobering. And look at how we are in relationship to other countries at the moment. Our degree of compatibility, our degree of connection with the world, because protecting our lifestyle and its indulgent surplus is at the paramount of why we do battle. And I think it's sad. So when we look at our individual relationship to pursuit of pleasure and how important it is, we begin to see what effect it has upon us when we are derived of that pleasure, deprived of that pleasure. The degree of irritation and anger that's caused when that occurs, and the kind of dullness that I see in this culture to a greater extent than some of the Eastern cultures, but pretty much in the West in general, a kind of dullness. Because if we're not pursuing pleasure, then life, for its very sake of living, doesn't have a lot of meaning. And we have derived our purpose and intentionality out of life is to create a pleasurable world for ourselves. And if that falters, then somehow we falter. We just have to wake up a little bit to this and look around and see what effect it has. Do we want to go through our life drugged or awake? And be careful what you say, because most of us won't jump at being awake. To look at our intentions in this practice is very important. It's not that once you have an intention, that you become fixed within that intention, but to be honest with what you are intending the practice to do for you. Is the practice to further your indulgence and pleasure? Now, you might find that hard to understand if you're new to the practice and you can't even find your breath, but believe me, there'll be a time when the breath will come very easily, and you'll find this deep, abiding sense of calm and peace, and you just can hang out there and be soothed. Dwell there a long time. In fact, I do a course the first week in September, right after another teacher does a month-long course on where he teaches people how to bathe themselves in these absorption of pleasurable qualities of mind. And some of them stay over and come to my week-long retreat, and they're hopeless. I can't get them out of that. I can't get them out of it. They have found their riches. And one person said, "But you know what? I can't understand why I'm so irritable after I go home." Well, you might want to question that. Say, why am I irritable? And what have I learned about what makes me irritable? Because this practice can mean anything to anyone. I mean, it's really, you write your own script on this thing. And all I want you to do is to know what your script is. That's all. Don't pretend you're being that you're living in pursuit of freedom and wakefulness and aliveness if you want to be soothed. Just be honest with that fact. Because the honesty will show you its limitation. If you're honest with it, you'll find the limitation of the pursuit of pleasure. You'll find it. Because it's finite. It has to show you its end. It has to show you its rub. So say, okay, I'm going to take this on. I really want pleasure. Now let me go right into it with eyes wide open. And see what happens when that pursuit is inconvenienced, disrupted, disoriented, when it comes to an end, anything. And see what happens to you, each one of us, in relationship to that ending. And you'll quickly understand why the Buddha said that the cause of suffering was that. So let's just do it with eyes wide open. And once eyes are wide open and you see the end of your original intention, then another intention will come through. Based on that honesty, a further intention will rise. It's not as if, again, that if you start out wanting to be soothed and seeking pleasure, that you will end up wanting to be soothed and seeking pleasure unless you refuse to look at what it means to seek pleasure only. So let's look at this exploration of self-indulgence. Self-indulgence. I mean, can any of us claim to be beyond self-indulgence? All we have to do is check our bodies out, where 2 out of every 3 adults are overweight. 1 out of every 3 adults get enough sleep. 1 out of every 10 adults get sufficient exercise. I did my background. So what are the reasons that we pursue self-indulgence? And what, especially in the Dharma scene, why is it that we won't give ourselves over to our deepest heart urge? And if we just are honest and look, it is not just a temporary abiding in pleasure. There's something under that. There's something that, well, again, we have to wake up to the honesty of it. Something that pulls us, that won't let go. But we seem to somehow, get off at, instead of going to the top of to the penthouse of freedom, we get off at the second floor and the third floor, and then we get back to the first floor. We get off at the fourth floor and back to the second floor, and it seems like we're in various stages of actually giving ourselves over to this urgency. Now, why is that? So let's look at some of the causes and reasons, if we could, for that. And none of these things are prison sentences. Again, they require eyes wide open. Please understand this, that if one of these reasons, and we'll go through a few, resonate within your life, all it is, it's not a... It's not blaming. No one's blaming you for having that, for getting off at the second floor. Just start examining. If you want to move the elevator on through these floors, we have to examine why it is that we keep getting off at lower levels. And it takes a willingness, the willingness to examine, the willingness to question. Part of you is outside of that neediness. Or you wouldn't question, you would just do it, and you would just be drugged into doing it. But what is going on here? To ask the question, is this true? Is this what I really want? And to pursue it, and to look at it. See, the looking is already on the penthouse floor. Now, some of you don't understand what I mean, but you will. So what are some of these? Okay, one. We're only partial in our effort. We hold back. We go for what's known and safe. And freedom sounds like, first of all, it doesn't sound like it's doable. It sounds like it's a little far out there. And I would like to bring myself along here. And so I want to go with what's known and safe. So I will take it one baby step at a time so that fear won't show itself. And the other thing is, how much effort is this going to take? I mean, when you have what we have had as a society, with as little effort as we have put forth to get it, then we expect the McDonald's approach to our spirituality. We want the Big Mac, and we only want to, you know, we don't want it to bankrupt us. So what's the catch here too? You know, I mean, because we're not used we're used to deceit and deceiving. We're used to manipulation. We're used to being sold a bill of goods. So you come to a spiritual program, and plus the bodies are extend out the row of slaughtered bodies in other spiritual scenes of manipulation and deceit and sexual stuff and all of that, that we have a guard, that we're just not going to give ourselves over here because we don't feel safe. We don't feel safe. And I want you to get out of here immediately if you do not feel safe with me. Do not stay one second. Because safety is your way of surrender. We have to feel safe in the environment. We have to feel safe that there's no one that's asking something from us that in any way manipulative. And so the person who teaches has to be based in sila, in ethical conduct. Has to be. Because the projection that comes from this role is enormous. And if I or anyone else buys into that, then the scene is a disaster. So, your sense of safety. And when you feel safe, you can trust. And when you trust, you can start giving yourself over without the glitch, without the hesitation. But what we really want to know is, how can I give the least effort and get the prize? That's what we really want to know. We want the secret teaching, not the mundane teaching. You know, if I have to go through the mundane teaching to get to the secret teaching, that's fine, but I'm on my way somewhere else. We have that kind of sense, I think. So the second reason that we hesitate is that we doubt the Dharma. We don't think it's true. We think, I mean, if you're really honest, you believe all this? isn't that a scary question? I love asking it because I know it's true. That's why I don't mind asking it. But I know most of you, many of you perhaps, don't. And many of you are relying on my confidence. And the reason that you can't give yourself over energetically is because you don't have that confidence or that assurance. And this stuff, like no self, excuse me. And all this mysticism, you get into really weird stuff in this thing. I don't see any of that. I walk down the street, nobody's appearing or disappearing, or I don't walk through buildings, nothing like that. And I sure feel like somebody, regardless of what this teaching may point, where this teaching may point. You see? Now there's something there. I'm not afraid of you doubting. I remember I was actually with Joseph back when I was just starting. And I had been sitting a few years, even before I got involved at IMS in 1976. And I was really trying hard. But I didn't know whether it was true or not. And we were riding or going together somewhere. And I turned to him, and I was really desperate, with tears in my eyes. I said, "Is this true?" And he said, "Yes." And I knew from where he said yes that it was true. And the tears flooded. It was all I needed. But the sense of doubt does arise. The sense of doubt is a part of this practice. Let's not be afraid of it. Let's not hide from it. Let's not make it into a shadow and pretend that we don't have moments in which we're questioning, now what am I getting into here? And let's keep this thing very basic so that what we're getting into is right in front of our eyes, where we can see the results. And as the practice develops and as we begin to get more settled in things and we begin to have insights, and most of you have had some insight, then you begin to see that this is what we perceive the world to be simply is not the way it is. And what we perceive ourselves to be is simply not the way it is. We see that. And then no one can take it from us. Not no one. Even if the Buddha were to come down here in some kind of magnificent image and glory, light the room up and say, "God, I'm really sorry, everybody, but I blew it. It's not true." I would say, "Would you excuse me, please?" And I would continue to teach. That's the assurance. In Zen, they say, when you meet the Buddha, kill him. Don't rely on him any longer. Let's move through this thing. And then it cannot be taken away from you. And that's where I want each of us to come to. That's my goal for you, is to have this motor of freedom, your heart urgency felt, and then your life will just flood open in its possibilities towards that end. So doubting is one of the reasons that we can't be full-hearted in our efforts and why we move towards indulgence. Doubting. And then, of course, we have self-doubting. Our culture in particular is full of a sense of failure. Secretly inside, many of us feel like a sense of failure as human beings. And so when we look at something that looks as if it's going to require enormous efforts and resolve, and we look at our past efforts and resolve, and we say, "I'm not up to the task." Fair enough, I'm not up to the task. And again, I say that you are up to the task. Because you're alive, you're up to the task. And this has nothing to do with failure. In fact, it has everything in going through that sense of failure so that we can see that that our potential is unlimited. But the failure can block that full-hearted response And we feel stuck and locked in ourselves, unable to generate the energy. And so then we fall back into the indulgence. And someone said indulgence was sadness of the heart, lethargy of the spirit. I was at the IMS teaching this last week, for the last week, which is, I apologize if I haven't answered your emails and all the things that I have, anyway. So there's one person there who's kind of a famous person who's well written a lot of spiritual books, and he came in for an interview, but I could feel that the lethargy was just so strong in this person. I wasn't sure I could touch him in the interview. I wasn't sure that he could awaken out of that. And he was so steeped in the philosophy of the tradition that he couldn't hear anything that you gave had the sense of, well, I already know that. And so his eyes remained dull. And yet he was crying out. He said, you know, there's no enthusiasm in me anymore. And he left early. Now, sophistication can be another reason that we don't allow ourselves to be regenerated. We know too much. I don't know how we can do that to ourselves, because it's so clear where knowledge takes us is a dead end. And it's so clear that to awaken into the spirit, to aliveness, to vitality, ageless vitality, what that takes as well. And then another reason is that many of us don't want to change. We don't want to let go and change. We want to know about what we need to do to change, but when it comes to the actual releasing that particular image or problem or difficulty or circumstance, well, we hedge our bets. When we're called, see, the practice is great in its glory and fantastic as long as it's philosophical. I can get into Buddhism as long as it remains outside. But when it starts actually working, and we can see right in front of us, release it. Release that. Release the anger. Release the self-righteousness and actually come to the point of connection, here, listening. Well, but I'm right. It doesn't matter. So is Bin Laden. That's not the point. The point is to release. I don't see. That's where we start hedging. Because that throws us back in on ourselves again. What we really want here is to come along in kind of a beautified form. You know, I would like to remain Rodney with a halo, thank you. So then everybody would appreciate my halo and say what a revered person he is, revered. Huh. And unfortunately, we can't take ourselves with us on this journey. Unfortunately, it is a journey of release, which is the only thing that saves any of us, because God knows what it would be like if it was a journey of embodiment. And moving on with these reasons, we see that the journey of spiritual awakening is to move into our uncomfortable areas, our discomfort. Whoa. Wait a second here. I wasn't... When we have a society that bases itself in the seeking and pursuit of better standards of living, more affluence, the betterment of conditions, doesn't this seem like regression here a little bit? Going into the difficult, I readily flinch when that occurs. Why do I want to go into the difficult? I can avoid it when I can avoid it. You can see, we can see how superficial we remain when we're not willing to go into the heart of this thing. I don't want to do that. But you know what saves us? Is that we know what we're doing, even as we're doing it. We know, I don't want to go in. You know that. You know what you're doing. That's what saves all of us from the side, the dead ends, is that you know, the knowing. Because even though we don't credit it, wakefulness is within us. And it sees, even as we are trying to deceive and to deny, it sees and it knows. It's the knowing. It doesn't say anything. It doesn't berate you for taking a side course. It doesn't. It'll let you spend your whole life in a dead end. But it knows. It knows. And you know because it knows. And it, like a grain of sand in an oyster, it begins to create friction. If you listen to it. But boy, you can go a long time and deny it. And comes the pearl. Okay, God, what have I been doing? I can't tell you how many people come to terms with that knowing in the course of interviews, on retreats, or just in dialoguing. God, I've known that. I've known I've been doing it. Now I see I have to stop. That's the saving grace, and it's also the hell of spiritual life. There wouldn't be a heaven without it. There's also a catch-22 about this whole thing. Because unless I show up completely, not too much is really revealed in terms of insight. But I won't show up completely unless something is revealed. I want proof going up here. I want proof that this is worth showing up for. If I have to make this strenuous journey, which... I say strenuous, but it only appears strenuous. It's actually relaxation. It's the journey of deeper relaxation, but never mind. That's a different talk. So the whole thing is about showing up. Showing up. And not having... Is our life so wonderful in the pursuit of pleasure that it's not worth testing? This theory, showing up, awareness. Because when we show up, then awareness sees what we've been doing to ourselves. It's the full accreditation of the knowing. Of course. Do you ever notice that when you listen to the Dharma, it's kind of like inward nodding the whole time? Oh, yeah, sure, of course. Yeah, right. Of course. Where is that coming from? Do you have the same knowing when you, in a geometry class? No. Why is that? Because it's already a part of us. The knowing is an affirmation, is a reinforcement. And what happens is that we get interested in our indulgence. The knowing, okay, what's going on? I have to check in here. I have to check this out. I have to show up for this thing. Let me look at, well, so we start watching our relationship to sleep and how deprived of sleep we are because we keep trying to milk more and more out of life at the end of the candle. We see how we distract ourselves in terms of entertainment and what we're doing, and that we just want to go into a kind of a zone of, we just don't want to think. And television is the perfect media for that. Or that we don't give up our pleasurable thoughts to come back to our breathing and our meditation. Just a little while longer. It's much nicer. Much more indulgent. Isn't that interesting? And we begin to see how we work with pain. Looking at how we work with pain in ourselves. And our willingness to go into it, explore it. The unpleasant, the other side of the equation. What do we think? Wholeness is going to come through from only the left hand? Wholeness, doesn't that mean that there has to be a right hand? Pleasure, pain, pleasure, pain. And then we see our laziness. And I'll give you a story of my own laziness. I was a monk, and as a monk, you don't have washing machines, so you have to heat water with a fire, you know, on logs, and put water, and then you heat it, and you put your robe in, and you only have two robes. You put your robe in there, and these things are huge, and you just scrub man, and it's really laborious. It takes the whole day to wash a set of robes, and it's quite detailed. So as a monk, I would procrastinate my washing of the robes. And I noticed that the people that would follow me on alms round were going further and further behind. And they used to call me Mahakasapa. Mahakasapa was the Buddhist's a renowned Buddhist disciple for his asceticism. He didn't wash or bathe or... You get it, right? So they started calling me Mahakasapa. And I was kind of honored that they were calling me. I didn't know... Until a Westerner tapped me on the shoulder and said, your robes stink. As only a Westerner would. So... That was, but you don't smell it when you're the. In any case, so you begin to see that if you don't live up to your own standards, then other people, it affects others as well. Our laziness has implications far beyond our own domain. So to look at our bodies for indications of complacency, check them out. Don't be afraid to look. Let's look at this thing. What's, our relationship to diet or food or exercise or sleep. I know I should, but is the voice of indulgence. So now you know what the voice of indulgence sounds like. I know I should. See, there's the knowing, but then there's the but. That's the trump of the knowing. The knowing is just the knowing. You're trumping the knowing with the but. And the knowing dies. It doesn't do anything but show you and wait for your excuses or your acknowledgement. That's all it'll ever do. So most of us counter the sense of self-indulgence with self-discipline. And believe me, there is a point and a purpose to self-discipline. In no way am I... Most of us only get out of bed in the morning through self-discipline and get up on the zafu or the bench or whatever we sit on through self-discipline. But it is not the only way. Self-discipline is a kind of... In its depth, not in any way to undermine its usefulness, but in its limitation... It is a counterforce of mind. It's the mind divided against itself. There's the mind that wants to be indulgent, and the mind is not going to have that mind be indulgent. And it's one part of the mind trying to control the contrary part. And so we do it through the flexing of our inward muscle. Now, that's different than self-discovery, which is looking at both sides of the mind. Look at this. I'm indulging in... Look at that. Where the interest is there. It's not a forced effort. It's not a whip. It's not hardness of heart. It's heart, period. Heart comes out. Heart. Oh. Self-discovery. And I'd just like to talk a little bit about the difference between commitment, and devotion. Commitment is a kind of discipline. I'm going to stay in the picture. I'm in a committed relationship, which means my body is going to be there with this person. Never mind, the heart may be journeys, miles from there. But the commitment is there, which is relatively shallow, really. Because you aren't showing up. Anybody can have their body there, but you're not showing up. Devotion requires you showing up, being there, present fully. And you begin to see that this path is not about commitment. Not in that way. It's about devotion. And I don't mean devotion to somebody. I mean devotion in the sense of showing up completely. Devoted to life. Devoted to your life by showing up. And you see that devotion has kindness at its base. Because to show up is also the act of forgiveness. And allowance, and letting everything be. It changes nothing when you show up. You're just the presence. The knowing is actualized. The knowing is highlighted. Entering the knowing and showing up. And so the middle way, which is what we're doing here, the middle path, it's not the path between self-indulgence on this hand and disciplining myself away from that self-indulgence on the other hand. Although that continuum is certainly where many of us spend much of our practice history. Fighting against my indulgence. Fighting against my pleasure seeking. Rather than understanding. You see, when you feel the word fighting against or disciplining myself against and understanding, immediately we're not in conflict. Immediately the heart is involved and listening and being receptive to both sides of the equation. What is this person that needs to discipline and what is this person that needs to indulge? Let me understand what indulgence is, how it unfolds and its limitation. Let me understand discipline and when to use it so that it can help me a little bit, but also the limitation of that. So that it's not a war of spirit, but rather an invitation to become whole in ourselves. And not just succumbing to the temptation of indulgence, which this life You know, if the Buddha is right, and I have no way of knowing about reincarnation, the earth you come back to, if you come back to this earth, is going to be in a far different shape than the one you're leaving. Because there aren't the resources anymore. So if you think you'll come back and just continue on as you are now, we better think again. That may be a wake-up call for us. If there's even an earth to come back to, if there's a species of human beings to come back to, so waking up because it's the time for us to wake up. Waking up because you already know the truth of your waking up. Just giving yourself over, showing up for this life, and not succumbing to the temptation of indulgence for the rest of it. May it be so for all of us. Can we sit for a moment or two?